in association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntris, and it's time to check in with Tim Seeley, one of my favorite guys in the Chicago area, a great Chicago creator who's a wonderful writer and wonderful artist. And you get both in his current Marvel miniseries, Ant-Man and the Wasp. He's the penciler and the writer on the series. Issue 2 of the 3-part mini comes out this week. We talk about the story so far and what's coming up. We also talk about Tim's creator-owned series, Hack Slash. He has wrested control of the property and now is in full control of the series, both as a creator and publisher. He's publishing it through Image. And we talk about My First Maniac, which is the prequel of Cassie Hack's adventures. We've talked to Tim about Hack Slash before on Word Balloon. Of course, it's a great series. Picture the girl from Halloween teaming up with Jason, and that'll give you an idea of what Hack Slash is all about. She's a monster hunter with a monster sidekick, and it's a great action parody of the horror genre in general. Tim's books are known for great-looking babes, great action, and a lot of funny stories as well. And you get that in Hack Slash in every issue and every trade. New trades are coming out. The My First Maniac trade is coming out this December, along with the third Hack Slash omnibus. Tim has big plans for January, the continuation of Hack Slash, the regular series starts. Plus, we'll see the return of Love Bunny and Mr. Hell. You'll hear all about it on this episode of Word Balloon. Today we're brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. You get a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, all at great discounts over the standard retail price. When it comes to Tim's books from Image, you'll get those books at 38% off the standard retail price at InStockTrades.com, and it is well represented with Hack Slash material from Tim Seeley. Omnibus 2, this is a great offer. $30 is the standard retail price. You can get it for $18.59. We go into detail on Omnibus Volume 2. Omnibus 1 is also available from InStockTrades.com. Again, 38% off the standard retail price, $18.59 instead of the $29.99 you'd normally pay. You can get individual arcs of Hack Slash 2 from InStockTrades.com. How about Volume 8, the Super Sidekick Sleepover? Teen superheroes meet teen slasher in suburban New Jersey. A very funny story. The standard retail price is $18.99. It's just $11.77 at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget about their sister site discount comic book service, DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs. Check out the values. They are waiting for you. And if your orders are $50 or more, you get free shipping at InStockTrades.com. In this current era of books always being late, Tim is an exception to the rule. His book is actually ahead of schedule. Because of that, issue 2 of the Ant-Man Wasp series comes out this week, Thursday. And we begin our conversation right there with Tim. If you don't mind, let's jump in, because I do want to start with Ant-Man. Because this week, issue 2 is coming out. And it did seem like
it was 3 weeks after the last one.
Right. Because, it was like November 10th was the first issue.
Yeah. And so we were very on time with doing the book, so I guess if you're early, they put it out. They don't wait until, technically 4 weeks or whatever. And I'm sure if we got it in even a week earlier, it would have just been every 2 weeks. So, they're just knocking them out.
Well, that's cool. Well, you're a one-man band on that thing. Now, you had an anchor for issue one. Did you have an anchor for issue one?
Yeah. I have an anchor and a colorist on that one. So I'm writing and penciling it.
Okay. Val Staples is coloring.
And I've got Victor Olazab on inks. And, he's doing a really great job. So I would have tried to go in there and say, hey, I'll ink it too. But I think, Marvel's kind of like, oh, we got you doing that stuff. So, I think there's that sort of thing of if you biff it, you don't want it to be all on you. So at least you have someone to blame, right? So if it comes out horribly awry, the inker, poor Victor, or Val messed it up,
Way to go, so, Val.
Usually I can blame, one or the other. If I wrote it and it sucks, I blame the penciler. Or if I draw it and it sucks, I blame the writer. But now it's it's got less guys to blame. But, I guess that's just the way it goes.
Well, I like it. I really didn't read much of Phil and Kirkman's and Andy's Irredeemable Ant-Man. But I'm aware of the character, and I certainly have been reading him in Secret Avengers and the different places that he's popped up. And I think this is, obviously this is your story, and I think you're playing to your strengths. It's kind of a fun, sexy story in some ways, and, you get to deal with the rascal that Ant-Man is compared to the good guy that Hank Pym is trying to be, and certainly more baggage on Hank, not only the death of Jan, but also the death of Bill Foster, and it seems like he's trying to address both in this miniseries with some of the things that he wants to do.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when because my editor on this is Jordan White, and he and I have worked together on a couple other things, and, you know, when he kind of just emailed me and said, hey, what would you do with Ant-Man and Wasp? And I was like, well, shit, I've got ideas, but then after I started thinking about it, I was like, why would you call me for that, you know? Like, I'm the guy that does that horror book, and I don't think people tend to think of, you know. But, I mean, once I started working on it, and I mean, I had ideas for it right off the bat, but once I started working on it, I was like, oh, I mean, yeah, why shouldn't I work on this? Because, you know, I've known Kirkman for, you know, 7 or 8 years or whatever, and I read that book, and I know what he was trying to do, and so that, I mean, and I can write, like, jerks and funny stuff. Okay, so, yeah, so that kind of ended up working out to my strength, but I think the toughest part was just sort of going in there and saying, all right, here's Hank Pym, and this is, like, a character that, I mean, I always liked as a kid. He was on West Coast Avengers when I was a kid, but, you know, since then, it's just, like, he's sort of a put-upon character where it's, like, he's not quite popular enough, so he's the guy that you have turn evil or, you know, do screwed up stuff or have sex with a robot that looks like his wife or whatever the case might be. I mean, you do that because, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, he's not a marquee player, right? If you screw up Hank or if you do have Hank do screwed up stuff, well, he's the original Avenger that doesn't really have very many action figures or a lunchbox or, you know?
True.
So going in there, it's like he's a great character and he's a Kirby character, and for all those reasons, he should have a lot of respect, and a lot of people have. You know, I think Slott really did a good job of sort of getting him towards, you know, of sort of at least sort of a place in the Marvel Universe. And then I think Gage has done a lot to move him towards that too. And then I guess all I needed to do in this story was, you know, set up Hank with a guy who is very different than him and hopefully make kind of Hank a likable character when he's sort of the star of the show. I mean, you know, it's a team-up book, but it's really kind of Hank's story, I think, in the end, you know? I mean, he's the foil against which the douchebag will be bumping up against, you know?
Well, they're very Felix and Oscar, obviously. This is the Odd Couple, and I mean, right down to the point where Eric is the irredeemable Ant-Man, and, you know, like I said, Hank is trying to redeem himself and some of the past mistakes and the people that he feels he, you know, was partially responsible for their demise. And it was interesting that Bill Foster, of all people, was brought up. I mean, he's become the Wasp to honor Jan, and you've got him right away coming up with the women's, you know, group to kind of help battered women and everything. But, yeah, I think the interesting turn that I don't know if anyone was expecting it was how to address Bill Foster's death.
Well, I think, you know, the toughest thing with that too was, you know, what was the one with all the Skrulls? I even forgot the name of it.
Oh, Secret Invasion.
Secret Invasion. That story, you know, you kind of find out that Hank has been a Skrull for a while and all this sort of stuff, and that happened while Civil War was going on. Hank was a Skrull and all this sort of stuff, and yeah, that's cool stuff for those stories, but it ends up being very difficult to have to explain when you're just dealing with, you know, a story about Hank and Eric, right? So part of the thing was I just didn't want to deal with that stuff, and we don't dwell on it too much. We just know that, you know, Hank feels, at least maybe he feels like he wasn't there for Bill or that he, you know, got him into this sort of business in the first place or whatever the case is, we just know he feels partially responsible for it. You know, I mean, I didn't want to deal with stuff like, oh, I was on registration side, but I was actually a Skrull at the time. And, you know, it's like, that's all good stuff for the sort of overarching storyline, but when you're dealing with one character, you know, you don't want to focus too much on the most confusing stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, I was really surprised when they killed off Bill Foster in Civil War because, you know, he is one of the few sort of, I mean, he's a super scientist black guy.
Right.
You know, like, and there's just not a lot of that sort of representation in comic books, you know.
Sure.
So, I mean, just from the point of view of just, you know, of kind of an interesting, possibly wasted character. I mean, I at least wanted to sort of touch on you know, Hank feeling bad about that, and then us getting to sort of see at least a sort of a consideration for, you know, the kind of guy that Bill Foster was and what he sort of meant to Hank, you know.
Well, and also, I'm curious to see. I like the idea of this, you know, cyber heaven that he's kind of created for him and stuff. And that was an interesting idea that you've kind of created. So,
well, it turns out after I wrote this story, then somebody told me, "Hey, yeah, they do that in Caprica." Like,
that's a good point. Yeah, that's true. Sure.
But the reality is that's actually real technology. The life log software is real stuff. That's, you know, I didn't make it up. It sort of comes from, I mean, I sort of, you know, pushed it in more of a Marvel Universe science fiction direction, but the idea came from real science, you know, really, they're working on some stuff, and it's actually kind of creepy, the applications that they have of it now, but the idea that they're working on now is that you could record, you know, sort of your memories and your brainwave patterns and all this sort of stuff into a giant computer, and they would be able to basically make a replica sort of robot that looked a little bit like you or mostly like you, and you'd be able to keep it around in, like, museums, and it would tell stories, and you could, you know, you'd be like the thing that your grandkids took to school, and grandpa tells stories, you know, the cybernetic robot copy of your dead relative, you know.
Wow.
It's real stuff. I didn't make it up, so... But this idea was just sort of taking that life log idea and, you know, making it so you have a guaranteed, you know, place after you die. If you don't believe in God and you don't believe in eternal life, then you could have science guarantee that for you. And then sort of the idea of how that would play into a character like Hank, who's an atheist and a super scientist, and then how it would play into a character like Eric, who is a bad person, you know, so... What would be the sort of the applications for someone who knows they're not going to heaven, even if they do believe in it, and someone who doesn't believe in that stuff at all? So, and, you know, just sort of throw in that kind of science fiction element.
So, and I don't want you to, you know, obviously tip your story or anything, but, you know, is, you know, I mean, given the direction and stuff, are we going to see some sort of pseudo Bill Foster Hank conversation before the miniseries is over?
You'll see a conversation. Yeah, actually, you will see it, sort of.
Okay. So, yeah, we can keep it oblique. That's all right.
Yeah, yeah. It happens in issue 3, but you'll, yeah, it happens sort of. I think that's the way to. But I mean, I would have loved to do. I mean, it's a 3-issue series, so
right.
I actually would have really liked to do more with the characters. Once I started writing, it's like there's probably a great conversation to be had between those two that doesn't last 2 pages. I mean, it could be great, you know, it could really be poignant stuff, but, you know, it's hard still, a sort of just fun action comic with some, you know, sort of pseudoscience, religious ideas, and, you know, so.
Well, don't feel...
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
No, go ahead.
I would have loved to have done it, so.
And don't feel bad about the Caprica thing, because I know talking to other Marvel writers that have been tripped up not only by Caprica, but also the revamp of Battlestar when it first started as well. And hell, I even know Bendis had a great idea for one story, and then he smacked his head because Life on Mars came along, and it kind of derailed the entire idea that he had. So, you know, it happens.
Well, I mean, and I always go by the theory that there's no original ideas, it's just how you execute them.
Sure.
So, I mean, I wouldn't really care. I mean, it's only the fact that, like, readers point it out, you know? I mean, I don't care, but... you know, as soon as you go on a message board, someone's like, "Oh, I thought it was on Caprica last week." You know, this is dumb. You know, so it's, you have to kind of, you know, I mean, it comes down to, I can always use the example of Walking Dead, which is, you know, it's just Night of the Living Dead, except it's done uniquely Kirkman. It's a new take, you know. It's not
sure. New.
I mean, it's just, we've seen that before, but there's a reason that it's still super popular, because the way it's done is so well, it's so well done, it's so uniquely done, but it's not a new idea, you know, like, we've seen it before. So I'm usually, you know, pretty simply, and, you know, you look at comics and TV and you're generating so many ideas all the time.
Sure.
It's impossible not to butt bump against that sort of stuff. So, but, yeah, especially since it's real life science, I don't feel too bad about it.
I want to talk about Walking Dead and some of the other stuff that's going on in horror right now, because I'm always interested in your point of view, because you're a big horror guy, and so we'll get to that stuff. But first, before we leave Ant-Man and the Wasp, tell me about this woman. Now, is she a brand new character?
Oh, Anesthesia?
Yes.
For years, one of my favorite Marvel characters from when I was a kid was the character Sleepwalker, which is like the most maligned D-list. One of the most maligned D-list Marvel characters, even though I thought it was a great idea, and I love the design, and I love the book, and I thought it was so imaginative and stuff. And so I've always wanted to do something with it. So I always had an idea of how you could use a Sleepwalker to be like the ultimate break-in, So that's how I used it in this story, but I didn't want to use, the previous Sleepwalker. So this is a character based on, she's half Sleepwalker, and she's kind of been raised by AIM to do dirty jobs for them, even though she's doing it just to, save her dad, who, in the original Sleepwalker story, when the Sleepwalker leaves your head, you have to be asleep. And he's been in a coma, so she's able to walk freely, but that's at the expense of this guy, and she's trying to get him help,
Sure.
So, yeah, we'll see a lot more of that. She gets a lot more play in issue two, and, kind of explain a little bit of the background. In fact, right off, I think the preview's out already, in issue two, you see them go to the Mindscape, which is the sort of weird realm that the Sleepwalkers come from. So,
mm-hmm.
So just, it was a chance to do something. I always love the sort of weird, expanded, multi-dimensional craziness that you could have in a Marvel or DC universe. And, this is, the Mindscape is relatively untouched, So I figured this was something I could do something new with and not have it conflict with a bunch of other stuff going on.
Sometimes, too, I maybe it's my own lack of Marvel knowledge, but this always seems to be more realms where the Atom exploits that ability of shrinking and be able to go to other dimensions. And I know that Hank with his Pym particles, Slot in Mighty Avengers, has, given us the Infinite Avengers Manor, and it had, all these different doors opening to various dimensions and different points around the world that he could travel to immediately and stuff. Is this familiar territory for Hank?
Yeah, this actually is something they kind of dealt with. Well, less Hank, but one of the original ideas in Marvel was the Microverse, which they
sure
used for the Micronauts. But
right,
the idea there was that they were, the smaller you get, you sort of disappear into a sub-microscopic universe, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
For Hank, that's probably nothing new. I mean, in this case, this isn't the reason. Well, it's kind of, you'll see in the issue two how they, how they get to this place, but he's basically using the sort of neurological weird path that causes this Mindscape thing to get there. A bunch of pseudoscience, blah, 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 Kirby crackle, et cetera, et cetera. I would assume that was definitely part of the storyline. And, we've never really seen that, as far as I know, like a sort of Ant-Man microverse thing. But, they've been dealing with it in Incredible Hulk lately, so.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Well, and
yeah, that is all part of the same, stuff.
And then I do have one crass question, because honestly, Tim, I'm enjoying the story, and I'm thrilled that you got the opportunity. But did Jordan ever explain why is there a need for this Ant-Man Wasp miniseries? Because, as you say, he's in Avengers Academy. It seems like there's been, plenty of room to exploit what, Hank is doing. And the same with Eric, for that matter. Brubaker's got him in Secret Avengers and stuff. Was it just using the name Ant-Man and the Wasp? Do you know why they wanted to?
I don't know the whys. I think Jordan kind of was like, I would love to see, these two. Basically, they'd never dealt with each other. If the Hank that, we saw Eric steal the original costume was a Skrull and et cetera, then we've never, confusing. But whatever the case may be, we never saw them interact, and it's never been dealt with.
That's true.
And, I don't know. It's tough.
I like them together, too. I think it's is a good dynamic, again, for their different backgrounds and what they're dealing with and everything. So I like the fact that they have put them together.
I know it's not going to set the world on fire in sales and stuff. And I think, Jordan had he wanted to see it, and we had a good take on it. And I think we tried, and hopefully we did something that maybe will, get people interested in doing another Ant-Man series, or, Yeah, I mean, it's like one of those things. It's like the sort of, you know, the Marvel DC both go, oh, we've got these great characters, we're not doing anything with them. Maybe we can get, you know, an Ant-Man series or something going, some interest. So it's that sort of thing, hey, if you like it, tell Marvel. But you know, I think the other thing, when Eric is in Secret Avengers, you don't, and in the initiative and all that sort of stuff, as much as there's stuff going on in there, it's not Eric's book, and you don't get to see him really act like himself. And none of his, you know, supporting cast or any of that stuff has been dealt with since the Kirkman book ended. You know, we didn't see his girlfriend again. We didn't see...
the jewel thief, yeah. The gentleman thief.
Yeah, Black Fox.
Yes.
None of that stuff had been dealt with. And, you know, this was an opportunity for us to, you know, call upon some of those great elements from Robert's series and then, I don't know, just kind of see how they work together. And you know, I think it's great that some sort of B-list Marvel characters get to get rotated in every once in a while and get some attention, even though they're not Deadpool or Spider-Man or whatever.
Well, believe me, if I would love to see more miniseries of Ant-Man if it means one less Deadpool book. I'm all for it.
Right.
Trust me.
Well, the thing is, it's like, you know, we say that, but hey, you know, readers buy it. So
I understand.
Yeah. You know, so it's always that sort of thing that, you know, if Marvel fans or comic fans, if you like something, you just got to tell them. You know, you got to tell Marvel and you got to tell your retailer and. Otherwise, you will end up with more Deadpool books, but that's because that's what you bought. So, you know, it's just like, that's just the business side of it. Hopefully, you know, the demand or excitement for a character like Ant-Man is good enough that the next time they bring him back, it won't have to be like Deadpool's team-up with Ant-Man, you know? hopefully it could be on his own, or, you know? So.
Sure. Well, and the other thing, too, is that I notice with a lot of these miniseries, I mean, you caught an interesting wave here because... they are kind of shitting these miniseries out just all over the place of a lot of these B and C characters. Beyond their life as trades, it'll be interesting to see how they do as digital properties as well going into next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's always that sort of weird thing, and we're all finding this out now, is that your audience in digital is going to be a different audience. It's not going to be the same people. It's going to be some of the same people, but it's not going to be the same people. So... you know, maybe a character like Ant-Man, you know, will have the kind of audience who, you know, who reads Penny Arcade and is interested in buying some Marvel digital comics. And I don't know. You know, it's going to be a really interesting couple of years as things kind of transition over and, you know, traditional print fandom meets sort of new digital fandom. It'll be cool. I can only imagine it to be good, but I don't know. I could be wrong.
Well, it really is a fun story, truly, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because I agree. I think it's something that could easily fly under the radar. People weren't necessarily asking for this. I hope that Jordan is happy, and I hope the feedback has been good from Marvel so far.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you know, you don't really know. You know, you kind of just...
Do they come back and say, hey, you know, thanks, that was great, or that's what we were looking for?
No, I mean, Jordan, you know, he's always been very, like, I mean, he was nothing but excited about this, and so was Tom Brevoort and stuff, and I worked with those guys, and they were very cool about it, but I think it's that, you know, I have a feeling that there's most people, I mean, most of the stuff that I got online from people was, oh, this is a fun, like, it's a fun thing, like they were surprised. Like, what was it going to be? Like, I guess maybe we've gotten so jaded and everybody just expects everything to be some part of some larger event and it's got to be, like, really dark and terrible and everybody has to get raped that, you know, that it's just like a fun, high-concept, big-science adventure Marvel book, which is, I guess, you know, maybe that's good that we got that every once in a while. I guess we'll see what kind of audience there is for that sort of thing still. I would hope it's still there and, you know, the people who remember... the sort of, you know, Tales to Astonish, good old fun, high concept, pseudoscience adventure stuff. We'll enjoy it. I guess we'll see.
It's funny, too, because I didn't even think of it. One of the other miniseries that I'm really enjoying right now is the Captain America Patriot book. And as you say, it is kind of steeped in tragedy rather than being kind of a fun, happy little, like, romp and everything. And, you know, I think you're right. I think we do need that. And also, again, going back to Hank... all this baggage that the guy's been carrying since Civil War, coming back and finding out all the shit that the Skrull did in his name.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think sometimes comic fans mistake, you know, I mean, I think you have to have drama in a story, obviously,
sure.
especially in a superhero story. Drama is great, you know, sort of, and danger, and you got to have that.
Conflict,
stuff,
yeah.
Conflict, absolutely, and fun stories can absolutely have that in spades, but I think it's the attitude and the approach that you take to it, and I think we've had a lot of dour, sort of hateful, you know, stuff where it's sort of like making fun of the reader and making fun of the characters and you know, and basically being unable to entertain you with wonder and excitement can only entertain you with shock and horror, you know, which I don't even do that in my horror comics.
Yes. So, this is true.
So, I mean, I would just hope that, you know, I hope people respond well to that sort of thing and want, have room for that kind of story. I mean, you know, by all means, enjoy those kind of stories that I just described, but I just hope we're not dominated by that and that's all we can take. You know, I mean, I know I'm sick of it. So
sure.
Hopefully other people are sort of interested in, you know, like a good, adventuresome, danger-filled, exciting romp. There we go.
Yeah, well, issue 2 comes out this week. I imagine first issue might still be out there as well in your stores. If you haven't cracked it open, by all means do so because it's a lot of fun. And let's move on to another fun book. And that's the wrap-up of your reintroduction of Cassie Hack and My First Maniac. I know that the miniseries wrapped up a while ago, but this is our first opportunity to talk about it. You know, how's it been so far? What's the response been? With this prequel and, you know, being able to take over the character fully again and really kind of, you know, dictating all the shots from top to bottom now. I mean, you always were able to creatively, but you know what I mean? It's taking the book image and everything.
But good, because we actually doubled in sales, which is awesome.
Fantastic.
I think it was cool because I was really afraid to do all the stuff you mentioned, which is to take the reins outside of just creative stuff, and it's a lot of work, and it's more work than I thought it would be, but no, I think, you know, it was just, I guess I had to kind of recognize what was working about the book, and what to exploit, and how to keep the old readers and bring in the new readers, and so far it's worked, and I hope that it keeps working, but I think, you know, My First Maniac was probably my favorite Hack/Slash story we've done, and I think just turned out, you know, the way that we wanted to. And, I'm just still in sort of a, you know, state where, I enjoyed how that went over, and I've enjoyed how people seem to like it, yet I'm still so focused on getting the next shit out. I haven't had a full, you know, day or two to even enjoy the last one. So, because we're jumping right into the ongoing, and we did, we did the annual, and we did the trailers book, which is, I didn't really do much there. All I had to do was read it. That was fun.
But the trailers book was fun. Talk about that for a second, because I don't know if everyone, you know, was aware of that.
Well, basically, you know, when I took the book from Devil's Due to Image, one of the things, there was a lot of leftover debt that Devil's Due had wanted to pay to creators, and they just weren't able to do so. So part of the deal of, you know, kind of cutting my contract short at Devil's Due was that I would pay off the remaining, you know, debt to people who hadn't been paid for the work they'd done on previous books. I've been chipping away at it, and I'm on a mailing group with a whole bunch of other creators, and I don't remember who specifically, but someone said, why don't we just do a book for you? We'll do it. We'll do all the stories, you know, we'll do shorts, we'll just give it to you. And, you know, and then they gave me stories, and all the proceeds will go towards paying off, you know, the people that we still have left on our list. And it was great. I mean, I basically just told them to do whatever they wanted. I suggested they do them like trailers, you know, like fake movie trailers, like we had done in our previous Hack/Slash story, but most people didn't. They kind of just did shorts. But and they just went wild. I didn't really edit it. I didn't restrict them. I just said, you know, turn in something that you want to do, have a good time with it. And, you know, my friend Sam Wells edited for me and put it all together. And basically all I had to do at the end was read the proof and send it out for print. but I mean, and that's one of those awesome things you can do with a creator-owned book. And, you know, I, I trusted my friends to do great stories, and I didn't really have to tell them what they could or couldn't do, but a lot of them got to do stuff that they hadn't gotten to do before. You know, Mike Norton got to write a story, and his is probably the most disturbing in it, featuring a sexually assaulting van. Yeah, it turned out great, man. You know, I couldn't be more grateful to those guys for, you know, just stepping in and saying, we're going to do this for fun, and you're going to benefit from it because you'll have some debt chipped away. So, I think people really enjoyed it. I mean, it was just, you know, again, it was going back to that, hey, we did a fun comic. We did a comic that hopefully made you laugh, and, you know, it was just a good time. So,
rattle off some of the other creators that were involved.
We have Gail Simone did a story, Chris Moreno, B. Clay Moore, Jay Torres, Alex Grecian, Riley Rothmo, Kyle Strom, Colin Bunn, let's see, Dennis Hopeless, Kevin Mellon, Chris Burnham, Stephen Molinar. We had so many good ones.
That's really great.
Yeah, and they just turned in like a silly sort of in the vein. I mean, all of them are, you know, like their interpretations of the book, which is something I always wanted to do, you know, just see what other people did with this book that I've written pretty much every story of since for 6 years, you know.
Well, and that has to be gratifying to see them take your characters and have fun.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's really something I would have loved to have done earlier, but I think you feel like you have to establish, you know, what you needed to be. But we've been around for long enough now that, you know, we have that freedom. You know, we're not quite at the level of, like, you know, do Bizarro comics and you can do a crazy-ass version of Aquaman and everybody laughs. But, I mean, I think everybody's familiar enough with the idea that it's like, hey, if we do a crazy one where there's alternate reality, you know, crazy hacks, it's fine. You know, it's not going to, you know, upset anybody that it's out of continuity or weird or whatever, you know.
What's the response been from readers?
Oh, all positive for that. I mean, it's definitely one of those things I think people just, you know, they knew what they were getting and they thoroughly enjoyed it. And like I get a lot of, you know, Twitter things, tweets where people are just, you know, they say what's their favorite story. So, which I like. I like, you know, and then I can set my friends against each other and say, hey, more people liked yours, and you should kill him, you know. Chicken fight to death or whatever.
And really, Tim, how do you communicate with your fans? I mean, you know, do you have the letters page? I mean, I wasn't really looking for the letters page. The times I do read Hackslash and everything, I don't, you know, so.
Yeah, and I think a lot of comics have obviously gotten rid of the letters page.
Right.
And we have one, but we, you know.
I know you're at DeviantArt, but where do your fans congregate?
You know, I just try to put up as many. I try to be super accessible. I think a lot of people do that, and that's why you have the Bendis Board and Miller World and all that sort of stuff. But you just try to be everywhere, and you know, I put my emails public. I'm on Twitter. My DeviantArt is public. I have a blog spot.
Do you have a message board? Do you have a message board? Do you have a message board or anything specifically for it?
I just have a hosted one on CBR.
Okay.
We're in the Image Comics one in there. And I post on there all the time. I think that's part of the thing. And, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but and you know this more than anybody. When you do this sort of thing, being visible and, you know, being accessible is really important. You know, I mean,
yep.
You're on Twitter and people talk to you on Twitter, you respond to everybody, and I try to do the same thing. So, you know, it's just we're at that level, sort of like I put fame in quotes that you can instantly talk to anybody who is interested enough to buy your book and allow you to buy groceries, you know. So, and I think that's great.
Well, and you're also, I mean, I see that there are Hackslash card games going on and stuff. I mean, I'm thrilled with all the merchandise that, you know, seems to be out there right now with Hackslash on it.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, in the past, when we were with Devils doing, you know, stuff would come in, but it was always sort of like, well, maybe it's not the right time or maybe we shouldn't do that. And as soon as I you know, took it over Image, and there was a chunk of money that I had to pay. I wanted to pay my creators off. Basically, anybody who said, "Hey, I've got a great idea for a product, and it'll be good," I'm like, "Do it!" You know.
Cool.
So the card game guys and some sketch cards, and I'm just at the point where it's, you know, if you have a great idea for Smackfest stuff and it looks good and I trust you, go crazy. We'll do something cool. Send me an email. So, yeah, and I think, you know, the collectible card game people are the kind of people who might be reading my book anyway, because they're probably not, you know, all superhero Marvel DC guys anyway, so.
Understood.
Okay.
Understood. And like you said, now, for Hack Slash, December is kind of a rest month for you.
Yeah, well, we had to get out all the trades. We were really kind of backed up on getting the trades out, because it was a lot tougher process than it was for me previously. So yeah, we took the month off, and the Omnibus will come out in December. Omnibus 3.
Omnibus 3 is coming out in December. Okay.
Yeah, which was supposed to come out in September or something, but yeah, whatever. We're a little late, so we'll get all that stuff out, kind of clear our plates off, and then be able to, you know, start on some new stuff. So,
will the My First Maniac trade be out also in December?
Yep. Yeah, it comes out not this week, but next week, I think.
Fantastic.
So yeah, everything that we had just had to get off our table. I'm so glad I took December off first with anything new, just so we could get all that stuff. So it actually looked like we have lots of shit out in December, even though we're supposed to have that before that.
That's all right. Hey man, it's Christmas time. That's all right. It's another reason why I'm glad to have you on in December, because that's something that I want to say about all my guests in December. I want people to go out and buy this stuff, because it's good stuff. And tell me,
I appreciate it.
What's in Omnibus 3? What special things beyond the issues themselves? Is Omnibus 3, by the way, is that going to have the Reanimator story?
That was in Omnibus 2. We actually did put that in 2. And then 3 has, you know, everything from, I think, issue 18. I always screw this up. 18 to 32 of the Devil's Due series. And then we also included the web strip that we did with Halloween Man.
Cool.
And then we included the crossover with the Living Corpse comic. Basically, you know, I let those guys do whatever they wanted. They did a story. I let them print it and do whatever they want. And then all they had to pay me back was they had to give me a story to put in Omnibus. So, so we get those story in Omnibus. You get basically everything from, you know, with Omnibus 3 being out, everybody will have everything before Image. Everything.
Cool.
So great. And, you know, that's a big fat-ass book.
All three of them are big fat-ass books. That's good.
Yeah, they're fucking huge. I always take them to comic conventions now, and I just fucking curse the entire time because they're so heavy. I'm going through the airport with this, like, bag of lead, you know?
God.
It's terrible, yeah.
No, but you're a good man. That's all right. And they're good and densely good, I guess would be the best way to say it. Yeah.
I mean, it's nice, you know, when you put out with the monthly books, you feel like that sort of effort and, oh, you're sweating, it's so hard to get these books out. And then you get that Omnibus in, and it just feels like you did something. You know, it's weighty. It's nice. It's like, you know, all my troubles and all of my, you know, trying to figure out how to end this story all culminated in this book that I could probably kill a rabbit with. You know, like if I had to, I could probably throw it and kill at least a small rabbit with it.
And I got to get the second Omnibus, because does that have the Jusco cover to Reanimator that you had all your...
It does have it in there.
Oh, man. Let me tell you,
I just hung out with him at Virginia Comic Con last week, and he wants to do another one, so I got to...
Fantastic. Oh, my God. I have to say, he really is one of my favorite artists that depicts Cassie and everything. I mean, that's...
Oh, man. Just one of the nicest dudes you ever meet in your life.
You bet. That's
cool. Yeah.
No, that's really cool, man. That's fantastic. And then it looks like it's going to be a big January for you, it sounds like, because not only are we going to see now Vlad's backstory.
Yep.
So that'll be fun. What can you tell us about that story as we're getting into it?
Well, it was just when we did you know, My First Maniac, I wasn't really – I had a Vlad story that I wanted to do, but I was kind of afraid that, you know, Vlad being not the hot chick, that his book wouldn't – if I do a Vlad story, it kind of wouldn't be as successful or popular. But I don't know, people kept asking me for it, so I just decided it had to be done. So we're doing, it's just a one-shot, but it's called Me Without You, and it's Vlad's story kind of just before he meets Cassian. It's another thing that we did with my first main act, which is, you know, it takes place before the stories we've seen, but it's a story we've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never been, you know, touched on or dealt with or anything. So, but in the course of the story, we find out, you know, how Vlad got to be the big mutant monster guy he is, and sort of all that stuff that we've never really dealt with. And we see his parents, which we've never seen.
Cool.
And we see his grandfather, who we've never seen, and it'll be cool. It's set in Chicago. Took tons of pictures and stuff around Chicago to send to Dan Leister. So I wanted to be very authentic and very Chicago-y. So.
Excellent. And there's got to still be hot chicks in it, even though it's Vlad's story, no?
Oh, of course.
Okay, come on. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's still high class, right?
Absolutely.
Like a skimp on a hot girl. But that'll be ridiculous.
Well, that's cool. And I introduced you to my friend Kaz at the first C2E2, who is just, you know, thrilled that Love Bunny and Mr. Hate are coming back. It is Mr. Hate, am I right?
Mr. Hill.
What is Mr. Hill?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Hell, thank you. God damn it. So let me say that again.
No, okay.
I already know. I suck that way. So Love Bunny and Mr. Hell coming back in January. And, yes, Kaz is thrilled. Can't believe it.
Great, yeah. I mean, it's just... You know, it was a book that I did a long time ago, I'm sure, but it's sort of a proto-hack slash in its sort of approach, and, you know, it always bugged me that we never released a color trade, and, you know, now that I'm at Image, I can do that, so fuck it, we're going to do it, and hopefully it goes over well and there's good response, and I will definitely do more if people, you know, pick up the book and... At least pay for the print run. I will do more.
would their worlds collide? Have they collided before?
Kind of. Basically, we did one story where Cassian Vlad fought this character who was a concept. Basically, she was like an animated literature character that, you know, she had so much. Her name was Mary Shelley Lovecraft. So she was kind of half. Half Mary Shelley, half H.P. Lovecraft. But anyway, so she went through all these different comic book worlds, and one of the worlds she went through was Love Me, Mr. Hell. So, and then we also did one where one of the characters animated a bunch of toys, and there was a Love Me, Mr. Hell toy in there. So they've never formally met, but we played with it a little bit. So.
Okay. And for people who've never read Love Bunny and Mr. Hell, tell them.
This one's easy. It's easier to explain than Hacklash. It's basically about a girl who was a sidekick her whole life, and she decides to be her own superheroine, but she's kind of ditzy, but not, she's kind of, and pretty bad, has pretty prone to bad luck. So she takes on her own partner, but unfortunately he's a sort of ravenous, all-consuming demon from hell. So, but it's kind of about, like, you know, it's a comedy book, but it's also sort of about, you know, relationships that are... maybe sort of weighted towards one of the friends, yet the other friend keeps it up when maybe they shouldn't. And but it's, you know, it's a big heart sort of humor book with the requisite amount of underpants shots and hot girls, because I guess that's what I do. So yeah, I mean, it was great to revisit it. It's being recolored by Nate Lovett, and we're doing the whole thing. It looks really nice. As far as the colors go, and I, you know, it's been long enough that I can look at the art and kind of appreciate it. I don't hate it.
Good.
So, that's good. Yeah.
Well, dude, I'm telling you, you know, you drew a love bunny for Kaz, and he, you know, was over the moon. He was so thrilled, and truly, it's one of his favorite pieces of you know, comic sketches that he owns. And
well, there's one thing about that book, and I, you know, when I first did it, I noticed it, and it was like it didn't find a big audience, but the people that found it, it was what they were looking for. And I think, you know, a lot of books where you are maybe a little bit weird, a little bit indie, you know, that is the case. But and that was how, you know, that was how I my experience with Love and Mr. Hell, which was just people would be out, you know, not a lot of people would ask me about it, but the ones that asked me about it, there was like a twinkle in their eye or something that I was like, wow, they really deeply liked this, you know? So I always loved it too, so I think it's time to give it a try and let people try it out. And I hope they do. I mean, at least, you know, the people who've tried out Hackslash, I think, are more likely to give it a try now. And it's really very sort of in the same vein. I think it's a little more ridiculous and a little less grisly, but it's in the same vein.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to ask is, What do your Hackslash fans think of when you do stuff like this, or even more recently, Colt Noble, something like that? I mean, do they follow you? Do they come on that stuff? Loaded Bible, another great, you know, interesting story.
Yeah, I think, I mean, horror fans are most, I think, the readers that I have in for Hackslash are sort of more horror fans. So I definitely, they follow me to Loaded Bible, which was awesome. I think when I come out with something like Loaded Bible, they go, what the fuck? It's just like whiplash, you know, like, what the hell is this? But, I mean, I'm not a guy of one interest, you know. I mean, I just like good stories, and I can be in just about any genre. So, I mean, I'm learning, you know. Cold Noble for me was immensely creatively satisfying, and it was a blast to do, and people seem to like it. But, you know, it's a little bit tougher to sell to my Hackslash readers, I think. And, you know, everybody who does something, I mean, it's tough for Bendis probably to sell some of his Ultimate Comics, Ultimate Spider-Man fans on Torso, or whatever, or, you know, especially when you jump over to different things, it's a little, you know, or Spawn for McFarlane to sell fans on Boof and the Bruise Crew. I mean, it's tough, you know? So, unless it's, you know, it's very similar, it's a little bit tougher, but. Yeah, but I mean, I think a lot of the people who maybe have read Hackslash for a while realize, you know, that it's a horror book, but it's also sort of, you know, a little bit of a parody and a little bit of a character study, and it's, you know, so we'll see.
Fair enough. I know you wrapped up you've wrapped up your Wildstorm stuff now?
Yep, my last issue came out last month, I think, and then I did some covers. So, yeah, Mike Miller did the last two issues of Wildcats, and they look really nice, so I'm happy with that.
Fair enough. Any DC stuff on the horizon, or?
I'm always talking.
Fair enough. Okay.
Nothing immediately. So we'll kind of see how. I've got I'm in that place now where I finished up my Marvel stuff, and I've got like awesome possibilities laid out. And I just got to pick which one is the way to go. So we'll kind of see. I mean, I've always got Hackslash looming over my schedule, so
sure.
Got that going. So we're going to see kind of which direction I go in now. Hopefully, I might be kind of ruined on. I enjoyed writing and drawing something so much that maybe I'll get to do that again.
That was honestly, man, it was great to see you do both. And I hope that I'm glad to hear that the Hackslash numbers are literally double, and that must, you know, make it easier then to, you know, be able to kind of pursue some of these other things as well. I don't know. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Very good. And, the other thing I wanted to talk about, too, in general, is just we've had so many interesting comic book movies and things coming up and TV. We mentioned The Walking Dead. We're five episodes in now and just about wrapping up next week. This weekend will, you know, be the wrap-up and everything. I think everyone's excited. I've heard you obviously praise it. You know, I mean, and you were even saying, obviously, that it hits all the right tropes of a zombie movie, and then of course it's still a Kirkman story, and that's what I love about it is how well it's obviously retained the Kirkman flavor even in this TV version.
Yeah, I mean, it's just we were talking about this studio today. I'm thrilled that like a lot of my friends are getting these adaptations that are so true to the source material. The Walking Dead show, Fire Breather, the cartoon, was amazingly true to the spirit of the...
I saw you tweet about it. Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, let's talk. This is my first chance to, since having Phil and Andy on a couple weeks ago and stuff, and I saw the preview, but, yeah, it was nice to see not only that the response was so good, but also I was really happy that Cartoon Network showed it a few times over Thanksgiving weekend, too.
Yeah, and it's, I was amazed by it because the tone of it was very much... The comic book was a sort of all ages comic, but you know, and it was the teenage stuff wasn't glossed over. It wasn't served to you on a with cotton candy. It was realistic. It was like, this is the way teenagers feel, and they kept that in the cartoon, which was pretty amazing. I wouldn't say it's just like. You know, the not just the awesome, the fun parts of being a teenager, but the tough parts. You know, the feeling like a freak and the social anxieties and stuff.
Sure.
Were all there, which was awesome. So I'm really happy to see those guys get these wonderful adaptations of their work. And then I'm also jealous because, you know, I've got the worst situation going with an adaptation with that godforsaken movie stuff. So,
What's happening with Hackslash? What's happening with Arnold?
Like a whole lot of nothing, I think. Corporations keep getting bought and sold, and every time they do that, it's new people, and people lose their jobs, and new people come over, and budgets get cut. It has nothing to do with the project. It just has everything to do with business. So,
is there a time where the option would go back to you if they don't do anything with it?
Not really, no.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
We'll see. It's always in the whatever process of things going on. It's just, I'm learning a lot. But I'm just more happy sort of that, and the great thing about The Walking Dead is that it's like the comic book. The numbers keep getting better for it.
Isn't that crazy?
Something about that property, that the way he approached that, not only does it sort of tap upon the zeitgeist of, people like zombie stuff, and haha, you can dress as a zombie and stumble around and groan. Oh, that's great. That's fine. That's part of it. But the real thing about that thing is you come for that and you stay for the emotions that it touches in you, which is this fear of what would I do without the structures and bounds of society? What kind of person would I be? And the comic book did that better than, and this is probably heresy, but it did it better than the Romero films did, I think, because they're two-hour movies and they have limited budgets. And the comic book did that better. And that's the part of the show that I think is resonating so well and getting that show rave reviews and getting it a lot of viewers. And making my wife, love the show. I mean, she waits for 9 o'clock on Sunday to come around, So.
No, that's cool. And, we've talked about True Blood just hanging out and everything, and how it is interesting how horror has really good horror, because, you got the weepy Twilight stuff, and, that's just kind of, I don't know, it's in that same realm. And don't get me wrong, I like Buffy, and I'm sure if Buffy hadn't existed, I probably would have liked Twilight enough. But, it's interesting that harder-edged horror is finding a place in pop culture beyond the usual horror market.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this for a couple of days. I think what's really happened is that, the film industry has failed the horror genre so spectacularly, simply because there's such a drive for huge blockbusters and things that have these giant audiences, and opening weekend is the only important thing to any studio. And so they go for usually the biggest and sort of both middle-of-the-road ideas and adaptations of stuff that previously existed, and any TV show like Yogi Bear or whatever. But, the horror stuff has never had huge audiences. It's always been about, getting those hardcore fans and then maybe drawing in some other people. But horror movies don't cost that much, so you see a lot of schlock that, soulless kind of crap being spit out in theaters, remakes and all this sort of stuff. And TV shows are able to capture that, the great horror stuff, the actual important stuff about horror, the human interaction, the feelings of dread, the things that make you think, and not just the fact that you jump in your seat and squeal, And that's all that movies have been able to capture in horror in the last 5 years, which is really sad. But TV is nailing it. I mean, Walking Dead and True Blood all these other sort of things that you're able to do now that you never would have been able to do before. So,
but they're
pretty cool.
They've got a larger canvas to do it on, and I mean, it really is just part of drama in general. Where Walking Dead, perfect example. You've got, in this first season, 6-plus hours versus the 2 hours, or not even that really, probably just hour and 40 minutes that you've, you know, normally gotten in a horror film. And as you say, they really did kind of get it down to a science of, okay, if we spend this much money, you know, we're going to still make this much in the box office, and we'll always have a profit. No, we're not going to, you know, break $100 million, but we don't need to break $100 million if we're only spending $12 million on the movie, and it opens to $30 million or something like that, and we end up making $60 million or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you see the surge in the remakes and that kind of thing, where it's like you're just, all they really want is that opening weekend and then DVD sales, you know, and it's obviously a good business practice, but you're seeing, like, the backlash being that, you know, for 6 months last year, I think every horror movie that came out bombed, even with the limited budget.
Really?
Yeah.
Even like the Drag Me to Hells and stuff like that?
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
yeah,
throw
yeah,
some titles at me.
Throw
titles at me that, you know, bomb, even though, that, like, I would think that they would have done fine.
Yeah, well,
that Paranormal Activity, obviously, didn't that do well?
Yeah, no, that was a big one. That was, you know, plus that cost so little, and that was part of the marketing of that movie, which was so genius. But, I mean, yeah, pretty much everything. Yeah, Drag Me to Hell was a bomb. I'm trying to think of the other stuff. Obviously, The Wolfman was a big tank.
Yeah, yeah.
God, I'm blanking sort of on...
No worries. Well, tell me beyond... All right, beyond
Splice
the...
was a big tank.
Oh, yes. All right, that's right. I forgot about Splice.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff, yeah. It was just...
Well, what about the Saw? All right, now, because, again, you watch all of these things, and literally I've seen one Saw movie. And I think it was the second or the third one, and that's the only one I saw. I would think that sequel after sequel after sequel, and following that story, that Saw was able to kind of tap into a little bit more depth than normal. Am I nuts? And no, I'm wrong. It was really
not really. I mean, but I think part of the selling point of those movies isn't that. I mean, it's obviously that they're full of really
torture
creative,
porn.
Fucked up torture stuff.
Yeah,
which,
torture
porn. You know, which is fine, whatever.
Oh, sure.
But I don't think they're... I don't think the longevity of those sort of things is going to be what you have with a show like a property like a True Blood or like a Walking Dead, where, you know, it really is about the character stuff, and the reason you feel fear is because you care about the characters. I mean, maybe not so much on True Blood, because they're not really, you don't care about them, you just think that they're cool and they get naked, but, you know, it's still a great show. I'm not dissing the show, that's not why you watch True Blood, let's face it. But
sure.
No, but I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of... a lot of those sort of theater movies, they failed because they lacked any sort of soul or heart. You know what I mean? I watched the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's kind of serviceable and stuff, but I mean, the kids that watch that aren't going to line up to see a sequel of that because it didn't really do anything to them. They're like, oh, yeah, that was kind of fun. I screamed and whatever.
Really, it was lacking compared to the first one.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, it just had none of the subversiveness. It had none of the creativity. It was gritty and dark, and it was kind of interesting, and it had some good special effects. And, you know, it wasn't horrible or anything, but it didn't...
No soul.
...do anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, there's not going to be fan sites dedicated to that film. There's not going to be... You know what I mean? There's not. It just didn't do anything. It's just... It was it. It came out. That's about all it did.
Who are the guys right now in movies that are doing it right? I mean, you know, like Eli Roth certainly built his reputation on things like Hostel and stuff like that. Again, that was more torture porn. But I mean, and I don't mean, I'm not trying to name names. I don't want you to call guys out that suck or anything, or that are good guys, and that, you know, I don't want you to break bad on Friends either. But like, who are the guys that are getting it right now as far as filmmakers?
Oh, man, it's tough because so much of the good horror stuff, I mean, the stuff that, and obviously, you know, because I'm not the audience that those studios are trying to get, because I'm not, you know, 17, and I'm not going to go on opening night and, you know, with a bunch of my friends and buy popcorn and make the theaters happy. But, you know, I think part of the thing is the ones that I've seen that have really impressed me as far as horror films go recently have all been sort of direct-to-video stuff.
Stuff like we're seeing on the Fear Channel and things like that. I mean, are those things good?
I've seen some good stuff. Some, but I mean, I think the best one I saw recently was a film called Frozen.
Frozen.
Which I totally recommend. It's a really cool film. It's about a guy named Adam Green, and it's about these kids that get stuck on a ski lift overnight, and it's free. You know, they're basically stuck there. It's freezing weather. They have to decide to get down. It's kind of a survival horror thing. Really well done.
Okay.
It just makes cold terrifying, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
Which is, yeah, great idea for a movie. And so simple, you know, but just that's the parts that really get you, you know? And I saw Wreck 2 in the summer, and I was just amazed by, I saw back-to-back Wreck 1 and Wreck 2, which are Spanish sort of zombie films, but just brilliant and really visceral and really cool and just so innovative, because the whole thing is told, basically you're the, you know, it's a first-person camera. It's really cool. It's remade into the American film Quarantine, the first one was.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah, but the second one is, I mean, I thought it was awesome. It's just crazy and really an innovative way to do, you know, a sequel to that movie where you're running around behind a camera, and then you're like, why do I need a sequel with another person running around behind a camera? Ah, they solved it. They totally figured it out. So, yeah, real cool stuff. But, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of things that have been really interesting, at least lately, whereas, you know, and I haven't watched Splice yet. It's sitting on my counter waiting to be watched, and it looks really fucked up.
So, no, I was curious about that. Now, I saw Let the Right One In, and I loved the original. I loved that.
Oh, yeah. I got to see Let Me In, too. I hear it's just as good, which is awesome and amazing.
Okay, because, yeah, I didn't, I saw the original. I'm always, you know, and I still haven't seen it, and I probably should see some of the Japanese films that, you know, were remade into the various films that, you know, we've seen in the last 10 years. From.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and tell you that those aren't that great. I'm probably going to get shit for this, but most of the ones that were redone were only about as good as the remakes.
Okay.
You know, none of them. I mean, honestly, The Ring, the remake of The Ring, is better than the Japanese one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know. Japanese stuff, there's some cool stuff, and a lot of them that are really innovative and creative will never be topped by, you know, like Tokyo Gore Police or something crazy like that. But, you know, some of the ones that it's sort of a take on the chain letter thing where it's like, you get a phone call and you're going to die, or you get an email and you're going to die, or, you know, someone pats you on the back and says, hey, and you're going to die, whatever. Those are all pretty...
One note, yeah.
Yeah, Pulse and all those films. The Eye, the original, which is, I think, Chinese. Actually.
Right, right.
They're okay. They're about as good as the remakes that came from them, you know?
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Shutter, all those same things.
Okay. And then, well, and I was going to ask, too, we were talking about different comic book things that have been out recently. Did you watch Young Justice?
I didn't get to watch that, actually. I was left for Thanksgiving, so I didn't get to see it. I hear it's great, and I've seen all the stuff because Mike Norton sits right behind me.
Yes, Mike's working on the comic, and yes.
So I've seen the Bible, and I've seen all the character designs. Don't tell DC, but I've seen them all. yeah, it looks amazing. I mean, the designs for it are just cool. It's exactly what Young Justice, I think, needs to, you know, reach kids, but it's cool. I mean, and I just saw the Joker design today, and it's awesome.
Oh, wow, cool.
Super awesome.
Okay, well, yeah, we didn't see that in the pilot, so I'm looking forward to that. No, I loved the pilot. I thought it was great. I've heard a couple people complain that Robin's too young, and, I mean, it's, you know, okay, because it's Dick Grayson, but I guess he's portrayed as, like, being about 13, or, you know, he's definitely young. He looks younger than the Aqualad and Kid Flash.
I always kind of like that, though. To me, that works. I always kind of thought, you know, I like Robin as the younger guy, but he's the boss, you know, like,
yes.
He's like 3 years younger than them, but he's better trained and smarter, and they're all like, oh, okay, we'll follow this kid, even though when you're a teenager, being 16 and them being 13 is like him being 4 and you being 20.
Exactly.
You
know? Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that stuff.
Well, no, I thought the characterizations were great. I wasn't a fan of the Teen Titans Go, and that's okay. I wasn't 7 years old. I wasn't the audience they were aiming it for. But I have to say this, much like the old Justice League series, I think is really great, and I think people are going to like it. Have you watched the Avengers cartoons on Disney?
I've caught one episode, and it looks really cool, too. I mean, that's another thing where it's like, this is combining all the stuff that appealed to me as a kid and then sort of bring it into a more modern stuff. It looks awesome. I love that kind of design, animation design. So
yeah, well, I think it's great, and I've seen most of them, and yeah, every time, you know, when I've seen the Black Panther and some of the other characters that they're bringing in, seems to me they got, you know, great takes on them, and that are at the heart absolutely lifted from the source material, and that as we said before, I mean, yeah, they're staying true to the source and, you know, figuring out a way to make it work on this other medium and everything. And I think, you know, would draw other people in and make them want to see this. So I've gotten other friends who used to read comics, much like I was able to get them to watch the Justice League cartoon, same group of guys. I'm like, hey, this Avengers thing, I'm telling you, if you like the Justice League, same with Young Justice. And they're like, oh, it was fantastic. So everyone seems to like it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I also have to give that Avengers cartoon major credit because they made Ant-Man cool.
Absolutely.
Props.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's true. It's very true. No, this is cool, man. Well, this is great, man. Hey, and I must thank you because they're not out yet, but it's my opportunity to tease the fact that Word Balloon T-shirts are coming. And
they look good.
Excellent. Well, you know, you're the man because the majority of it is the fine artwork from one Tim Seeley, who took my suggestions and came up with a wonderful collage of characters. And as I knew he would, I mean, I knew I was dealing with the right guy and making it happen. And I'm very pleased with the design and look forward to letting everybody see it when it is ready for market. And that is just hopefully no more than days or weeks away.
Awesome, man. And I'm glad that we were able to eliminate that line that made it look like I made your head fat.
It was the third chin that I actually do have, but I'm just like, can you erase that? Can you just give me like, I'll take even a Jay Leno chin. Just don't give me like, I didn't want a scrotum sack for under my head, under my chin, man. That was my only complaint. That was my only concern.
That's the bad guy in Ant-Man issue too. Actually, scrotum sack. Scrotum chin. He's a mobster, big old fucking balls on his face.
So. Outstanding. Well, dude, it seems like the Empire is moving forward, and I'm very happy about that. I honestly see the momentum, Tim.
All right, well, I owe it a lot to you, John.
So shut up. I've been nothing but a happy bystander that is enjoying your success. And no, seriously, keep it up. And really, lots of great product for Hackslash coming out in December, along with the Ant-Man and Wasp miniseries. More stuff coming in January when the Hackslash series fires up, and we're going to look forward to Love Bunny and Mr. Hell. Mr. Hell?
Aha, you got it. All right.
Son of a bitch. Okay, there we go. See? I'm too focused on Love Bunny for obvious reasons, man.
Yeah. She got a heart on her boobs. It's impossible to look away.
She's a doll. So, no, seriously, man, thanks a lot for talking, and look forward to catching up later on, too.
All right, man. Thanks much. We'll talk to you soon.
My thanks to Tim Seeley. Make sure you check out Hackslash and all the other fine books we discussed this week, including Ant-Man and the Wasp. Issue 2 comes out Thursday from Marvel Comics. It's a great mini-series, and as Tim says, it is a nice, fun series in contrast to all the grim and dour stories that you might see right now on the stands. It's funny stuff from Tim Seeley, both from an art standpoint and a writing standpoint. Today's episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Great value and great savings, up to 38% off the standard retail price on a lot of Tim Seeley merchandise at InStockTrades.com. Hackslash is well represented. You can pick up any of the trades that are available there. The standard retail price is $18.99, but at InStockTrades.com, you can get Hackslash trades for just $11.77. Or get the omnibus editions of Hackslash. 1 and 2 are available currently. The standard retail price is $29.99, $18.59 at InStock Trades. Check out all the deals. They are waiting for you. All the publishers are represented there. And $50 or more on your order, you get free shipping. It's all waiting at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening. The voice is still a little shot. So we're going to wrap things up and say if you need to reach me via email, contact me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.